From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Detroit police have a person of interest in a string of suspected serial killings.
All three of these victims were positioned in a kneeling position after death.
We'll hear how police are building their case. End-of-life conversations with teens facing life-threatening illness.
So I was exploring if the adolescents do want to talk about it and what they want to talk about.
I called her and I was like, hey, am I going to die or when, how? Because these were real questions that I had when I was contemplating doing chemo.
Making summer school something kids will go to.
We have more flexibility. We are able to think outside of the box and provide activities that are more engaging and fun and don't worry so much about testing, for example.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, teens coping with life-threatening illness and how parents and physicians can help.
The first time that I was told that my prognosis was really not that good, I was in high school, I couldn't even drive yet, and I honestly never thought that I would even graduate high school, let alone make it to college.
That comes up later this hour, but first. Detroit Police Chief James Craig went before City Council today with a public safety update. It comes as Detroiter D'Angelo Martin was charged in a rape case. And yesterday, during a press conference, Chief Craig declared Martin as a person of interest in the murders of three women.
We looked at patterns and similarities. As you heard me say last week, the signature. And it was through that signature that we believed that there was some connection. But again, we are still very much involved in this investigation, so I'm limited as to what I can say.
George Hunter has been covering this story for the Detroit News, and he's with us now. And we should caution you, we'll be discussing crimes of sexual violence. George, what did Chief Craig tell counsel today about this case they're building?
I talked to him about this case, and then one of the big issues was other crimes that were going on. So there's not a lot they can say publicly yet, but I can, and I knew this information about the kneeling. My sources were telling me like last week, but there's always a ethical dilemma as a journalist. The demarcation line is always: does the public have a right to know this right now? Because if I put this information out there, then that could muddy the waters and a copycat, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so once the DNA came back, then I felt confident as in my role as, serving the public and you know what I mean? And I take that very seriously. It's okay to put this out right now because they got it, the DNA match.
So right.
If there's a copycat, then they'll be able to determine that it is because the DNA won't match.
So you're referring to the signature that Chief Craig referred to. Tell us about that.
Yeah, he said there was a signature. Now, what my sources told me is that all three of these victims were positioned in a kneeling position after death, and condoms were left right next to them, used condoms. That's how they were able to catch this guy, is that the Michigan State Police expedited the DNA test, because that sometimes can take weeks. It takes a long time usually, but I guess they scrambled to get this done, and according to my sources, they were able to match, they all matched to this suspect.
And all three of these victims worked in the sex trade, correct?
Yes, and that's not unusual. I covered a serial killer back in 2000, Armstrong, and that was his M.O., and it was also Atkins. Benjamin Atkins was the Woodward Corridor killer in the 80s. And then in the 70s, there was a guy named Bigfoot who was terrorizing Cass Corridor prostitutes, and that's not unusual. They, as the chief was saying yesterday, they... prostitutes are often on the fringes of society. If they go missing, there aren't many people often who are going to report them missing. Mm. And so, a lot of these guys have sexual perversions. For instance, in this case, he's raping these women, and he's choking them and then raping them. And in fact, one of the women got away. That was another thing that was in my story that my sources told me, is that he dragged her into the same house where one of the other bodies had been found on Mack Avenue, and he choked her. She passed out, and as he was raping her, she woke up. I guess he must have thought she was dead, maybe, and she was able to cut him, and then he got away, and she called police. And then the police arrested one man. They followed the blood trail, and there was a man who matched the description, and they arrested him. And after the arrest, the woman picked him out of a lineup. But the investigators said, no, we still need to push because we're not sure. Because, very often lineup identifications. I can't tell you how many wrongful conviction cases I've covered that where people were improperly picked out of a lineup.
Sure.
And later on it was determined that that was a mistake. So they wanted to keep pressing forward in the investigation, even though they thought they might have the guy. And as it turns out, that wasn't the guy. Because the, you know, the, when they picked up the suspect, he had stab marks that were consistent with the woman's story that she had stabbed him. So then when the DNA came back, then it's conclusive that, you know, that that's their guy.
George, what about more victims? I know there's a Ferndale case with a woman who's still missing that could be linked to Martin. So what do they think about other victims?
They're keeping that possibility open. I mean, they're searching still through the houses on the east side, and that's just gruesome. I don't know if you watched The Wire, but that was literally the plot point of one of the seasons, is that they were searching in abandoned houses and structures to find bodies. So one of the interesting questions, I was talking with some cops about this just yesterday. It's not unusual in Detroit for firefighters or people playing around or whatever to find bodies in these abandoned houses, and many times they're just written off as drug overdoses because they're in a decomposition, and it's very difficult to tell a strangulation. That's almost impossible when you have a body that's decomposed, because all the ligature marks, all the indicators of strangulation that are on the skin generally aren't there. So if you have an overworked ME's office, oftentimes they'll just go ahead and say, you know, this is a drug overdose. That's what my sources are telling me, and they're wondering, you know, how many of these are homicides? How many more, you know, homicides, not necessarily by this suspect, but maybe by other people? And just the idea that there could be bodies in these houses, there are bodies. There's no question about that. I talk to some firefighters, you know, all the time, and that's why I quoted them in my story the other day, because I've talked to them in the past. I've talked to tow truck drivers. And, you know, say the people who tow, you know, for the city, and they say the same thing. It's a regular occurrence to find bodies sitting in a car somewhere that were homicide victims. It's kind of very chilling, but that's part of life in Detroit.
George Hunter, Detroit news reporter, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
After years of troubled finances and poor academic performance, Governor Gretchen Whitmer says closing Benton Harbor High School is the best way to save the district. At a school board meeting last week, Sonia Brown from Albion warned Benton Harbor residents against that plan.
Do not vote away your high school. If Governor Whitmer is bold enough to shut you down, you make her come in here and own it and do it. You don't do it.
Albion schools faced a similar situation in 2013. The city's only high school closed, and the district was converted to K-8. How did that work out for students? Ron French of Bridge Magazine, the situation was similar. Poor, majority black district, low student test scores, high debt.
Remarkably similar, Cindy. As you said, it was a low-income district and a majority-minority student population surrounded by predominantly white school districts. And the school had a lot of debt. The scores were very low. And it's hard to argue. It was a failing school that was failing its kids.
And in Albion, the school board voted to close the high school. Benton Harbor School Board is refusing to even vote on the Whitmer plan. And if they don't have that viable alternative, she, as we heard, is warning the whole district could be dissolved. Does that pressure from the state change the dynamics?
Oh, it absolutely does. That's basically what happened in Albion, too. There was a lot of pressure to find a way to resolve the debt. The test scores were unacceptable. And there what you had were a couple of dynamic leaders. You had superintendents in both Albion and Marshall who worked together, who spent about a year coming up with a plan to transfer all the kids from Albion High School to Marshall High School. It's 13 miles away. They bus them every day. And what happened there is that you found that the kids, despite all the concerns, the kids were surprisingly successful.
So they did succeed. They did do better in a way they might not have if they'd stayed in Albion.
Right. And I know that's the big concern in Benton Harbor, as it should be. Every family wants their kids to succeed. And they also want their local high school to stay open. The high school is the center of a community in small towns like this. But what we found from looking at experience in Albion, what happened is that the students who live in Albion graduate from high school at a much higher rate at Marshall than they were at their own high school. For example, the last 4 years that Albion High School was open, the graduation rate ranged from 58%, which is just shockingly low, to 84%, depending on the year. At Marshall, those same cohort of kids, the ones who live in Albion, they're graduating at a 94% clip. And that's higher than the state average for everyone. They're just 1 or 2% points off of the graduation rate of the kids who grew up in Marshall, who are have a much higher income.
But ultimately, closing the high school didn't save the K-8. It didn't save the district. Is that likely to have the same outcome in Benton Harbor?
That's something that we should look at as a community and as a state. In Albion, closing the high school was billed as a way to save the district at least through eighth grade because high schools are more expensive, and that way they could focus on the earlier grades, just like they're saying in Benton Harbor. Well, think about it. If you're a parent who lives there and you know that your child is going to have to transfer to another school district in ninth grade, do you want them to stay in that district for 8 years, make friends, and then have to go find new friends? Or do you think, well, heck, I might as well just start them out in kindergarten in another district? So you saw a lot of kids move out of the district. The enrollment became so low it was untenable, and so they ended up merging the rest of the Albion district into Marshall.
So, Ron, the high schoolers are doing better in Marshall. What about the younger kids?
It's maybe a little too early to tell. There is one elementary school that remains physically open in Albion. It is run by Marshall now with a new staff. It's been run under the auspices of Marshall for 2 years. So far, they haven't shown any improvement in test scores. Usually it takes 2, 3, 4 years to make a determination, but we can't tell yet.
So bottom line, briefly, what lessons should Governor Whitmer and Benton Harbor take from Albion?
That students can learn more in other districts. There's nothing to be afraid of, but you should also be realistic that the district could close completely.
Ron French, Bridge Magazine. As always, it is good to talk with you, Ron. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, how summer learning programs can make a difference in students' academic progress and reducing summer slide.
Some of them don't have access to books. Some of them don't have access to adults who read to them regularly. And so summer learning programs may be able to provide that access to literacy in general.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's time for Theater Talk as we say hello to David Kiley from Encore, Michigan. The 73rd Annual Tony Awards happened this past Sunday night with Hadestown winning Best New Musical and Detroiter Celia Keenan-Bolger winning a Tony for her featured role as Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird. We both saw her. She was spectacular.
She was really good. And, you know, it's an interesting play because in the movie that everybody's familiar with, Scout as a Child, but in the Aaron Sorkin adaptation, she's an adult, and it's kind of flashback, but it worked really well.
Thanks to her.
Thanks to her. And, you know, I didn't see Bryan Cranston in Network. I did see Jeff Daniels in To Kill a Mockingbird. I think you and I both agree he was spectacular. I don't know how spectacular Bryan Cranston was because I didn't see it.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
He's been nominated twice, Cranston, and won both times. And Jeff's been nominated like a few times anyway.
And still, is looking for that.
And still looking for the win. So,
but it does lead me to ask you what is new with the Michigan version of the Tonys, the Wild Awards.
That's right. So the critics and I met over the weekend, actually, and we hashed out our nominations for the Wild Awards. That's our annual show, which will be in August. And as you say, it's kind of the Michigan Tony Awards of all the professional theaters that we cover and review. And I got to say, what was remarkable is how many new plays we found ourselves deliberating over. Plays by Michigan playwrights and some who are out of state but have roots here. In fact, we had so many plays that were great that this year we split the category into dramas and comedies because there's been a little bit of call for that in past years, but this year we had such a riches that we're like, we have to do it because we just can't acknowledge enough of the good plays.
So good theater being done. And you have a new location.
Yes. In the past several years, we've been at the Berman Center for Performing Arts in West Bloomfield, and that relationship has come to an end. But I'm very happy to say we're going to be at the Hilbury Theater in Detroit with Wayne State, which is the Wayne State Main Theater. And it's on August 26th. It is open to the public. So when we publish the post for that has all the ticket info, if you're a member of the public and you're kind of theater geek, it's a great night. And you get to see some of the best performers in the state. It's a terrific night, and we like to open it up for the public.
All right. We got to dive into the summer theater season for Michigan in full swing, and we're going to start at the Barn in Augusta.
Yeah. So Augusta, just for people who may not have been there, takes about an hour and a half west of Ann Arbor driving, and they're opening a show called Love Lies and the Doctor's Dilemma. And as its title suggests, it's a comedy farce about, it's got mistaken identity, there's a gangster bodyguard, there's a former movie star, there's a psychiatrist. This is one of those silly nights out, which the Barn does these kind of shows very well. I just saw the Disaster, the musical there, which is as silly a night as you can imagine. And they did a very nice job with it. So that opens this week, Love Lies in the Doctor's Dilemma.
And now to the Jewish Ensemble Theater, marking a very big birthday this year.
Yeah, they are doing their 30th season. This is a big year for them. It's a new space. They used to be at the JCC campus in West Bloomfield, same place as the Berman Center. But they lost their space and their lease last year. So they're opening in Walled Lake, literally 5 miles down the road.
West of the Jewish Community
West
Center.
West of JCC.
Yeah.
I was there this past week with Chris Brummer, who's the artistic director. And they're opening with The Odd Couple, which is a good seat filler. And I talked to Chris at the new space while there was construction going on. But they actually have their gala tonight. So and I asked him a bit about why he chose the Neil Simon Classic.
Well, we chose The Odd Couple because it's an iconic American play. And sadly, we lost Neil Simon last year. And the truth is, Jewish Ensemble Theater has never done it. So we're really excited to bring it to a whole new group of people in a whole new space and have a fabulous show that everyone will enjoy.
All right, so that should be fun. Who doesn't love Neil Simon? So that's The Odd Couple at the Jewish Ensemble Theater in their new home in Walled Lake. Now to West Michigan, to Farmer's Alley in Kalamazoo. What's opening there?
Yeah, so this is not a summer theater, but they do operate in the summer. And they opened Fun Home this past weekend. And our critic really liked this production. Farmers Alley is a very good theater. So if you find yourself out in the Kalamazoo area, definitely check it out for this show or any other show. This is a musical, which had a great run on Broadway, and it has been through Detroit before. Story focuses on a young woman who's coming of age, and she realizes that she's gay. And the story in the musical is about her coming of age with her sexual identity and also developing a relationship with her father, who is gay, but not out to his family. So it's an interesting tension. The music and the
days
tunes are terrific. Here's a clip.
And days, that's how it happens. Days and days. Made of posing and bragging and fits of rage. And boys, my God, some of them underage. And oh, how did it all happen here?
And that was the original Broadway cast recording of Fun Home. And I know it was a big hit when it played at the Fisher. So it's a chance to catch it at Farmer's Alley in Kalamazoo. And then we wrap up in Ferndale at the Slipstream Initiative.
Yeah, so in keeping with our Wild Award announcement, they're doing a play in conjunction with Pride Month called Gross Indecency. And this is about the trials of Oscar Wilde. And the play stars Richard Payton as Oscar Wilde. And I got to say, Richard has really distinguished himself as one of the top actors in Michigan. And he really slays this role. There's humor. But it's poignant. I mean, this was the trial that really wrecked Oscar Wilde's life. as intolerant as some people are today of gay, of LGBTQ, much more so in England in the 19th century when Oscar lived.
Absolutely. Well, lots of summer theater for us to enjoy, and you can get details of these and lots of other Michigan theater productions. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, thank you.
Thanks so much, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Percent of Michigan kids come from low-income families, and getting that extra boost over the summer could help them through school and into higher education, a way out and up. Elizabeth Isidro directs the McGinnis Reading Center and Clinic at Western Michigan University, where she's an assistant professor of literacy studies. The McGinnis Center runs summer programs for students in Kalamazoo. Elizabeth, how do you see these summer programs making a difference for the kids who come? Why does summer learning matter for them?
Well, there are several reasons how these summer learning programs benefit students. For one, we know this thing called summer learning slide. And during this time, students don't have regular access to literacy activities. Some of them don't have access to books. Some of them don't have access to adults who read to them regularly. And so summer learning programs may be able to provide that access to literacy in general, to avoid that slide. So they say during that slide, whatever reading level they have achieved at the end of the school year in May not be the same reading level when they start back up in August. And so there's the slide. And so if students have that access or continued access or sustained access throughout the summer to these literacy activities, then somehow we minimize, if not prevent, that slide. And then another reason how summer learning programs benefit students is for those students who, let's say, they are not most likely to experience the slide because they have or they are in home environments that are very supportive and still continue to provide them access to literacy and literacy activities. The other way that we can benefit these students through the summer learning programs would be through the enrichment activities that summer learning programs may be able to offer.
Besides the cost, what are some of the challenges these kids face to get into a summer learning program? Knowing we certainly is clear these are really, really helpful. What keeps kids from getting this kind of help?
Yeah, that's a good question. So students who come from low-income families, basically, the families deal with other challenges such as transportation. So sure, they would like, let's say the parents would like their children to go to a tutoring program, for example, or the summer camp. But, and then let's say they will be eligible for the scholarship, but let's say they have inconsistent transportation. So that would be a hurdle that they still have to think about. Another challenge that they may be facing would be, let's say, the parents have other children, like really young children, and then it's hard for them to leave the young children at home, or the other option is to just take the whole family to the reading center so that one of their children can attend our program. So that might be another issue for the parents. If they had, let's say, childcare, then that might not be so much of an issue for the parents. But then again, that's another possible issue that they're facing.
What about the rest of the summer? What could parents do through the summer? Because it's a lot of other empty hours to help fight that summer slide and keep kids on point.
We hope that during those times, the parents and the families are availing of other activities offered in the city. So, for example, I update our Facebook page with suggested activities to the parents. These are activities that don't require expensive resources or fancy materials. Most of the time, activities that I suggest would be vocabulary building activities or conversations they might have over a book they might have checked out from the library, for example. What kind of rhyming activities in order to develop phonemic awareness. sound manipulation activities that they could have with their children on their way to the grocery, for example. So these activities all contribute to their child's literacy development without them having to spend money or, again, buy expensive resources.
Just briefly as we wrap up, what is at stake here for a youngster who's academically struggling? What can a summer learning program mean to them?
Well, it means a lot, especially for the younger ones. They say that by kindergarten, children should have accumulated 5,000 vocabulary words, for example. But if you come from families who are not able to provide those early literacy activities or supports, then they already at the get-go in kindergarten will be behind compared to their peers. And so these summer learning programs are able to provide those additional activities that are not based in school, but based in centers like our reading center and others. There are other centers, and even the public library would be another possible venue for that. But also, a lot of times the school would have to base their programs on a certain curriculum that's state approved. While for summer learning programs, we think about the standards that are needed to be addressed, but we have more flexibility. Hence, we are able to think outside of the box and provide activities that are more engaging and fun and don't worry so much about testing, for example. And that's something, too, that happens a lot in schools.
And that makes me wonder, do the kids come willingly or do some of them have to get marched in by a parent?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, based on my experience, I don't see the kids being marched in. Instead, I see them rushing and leaving their parents behind. So, for example, the parent would still be by the stairs and they're already at the door trying to get into to the reading center. So I hope that's a good sign that they have this excitement. I also hear from parents how in school their children sort of struggle and don't have that engagement, but coming to the center, their children are able to be more motivated to work with our tutors, for example, and engage in the activities in a manner that the parents don't see happen in the schools a lot.
So I think I hear you saying, parents and students, have your minds open and don't be afraid of summer learning programs.
Oh, definitely. Yes.
Elizabeth Isidro directs the McGinnis Reading Center and Clinic at Western Michigan University. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside, Elizabeth.
You're very welcome.
David Hornibrook grew up in the suburbs of Detroit, where he worked for years as a caregiver and nonprofit administrator. Well, now he adds published poet to his resume. Our reviewer, John Freeman, tells us how Hornibrook brings empathy and imagination to his writing.
David Hornibrook's debut collection of poems, Night Manual, skillfully reflects the tension between the bustle of the contemporary world and the quiet contemplation of larger existential questions. Walking the causeway at St. John's Marsh and finding God stepping on the carcass of a Massasauga rattler, or turning onto Lancaster Avenue, where a group of strangers hold black umbrellas and wait beside the road, and realizing this bus is already years late. The result is poetry that is at once spare, imagistic, and incisive. The poem Preservation begins, "On a Tuesday, I leave work early and drive to a small gravel parking lot beyond which St. John's Marsh stretches into pale distance." For the first seven stanzas, this seems like an idyllic piece about escaping from daily life. By the end of the poem, Hornibrook contemplates an article about black holes while watching a bass plunge into the depths of the marsh. This seamless fusion of the provincial and the celestial, one the poet repeats several times in the book, distinguishes this work from mere provincial poetry. The poem ends, "Supermassive and unhinged, black holes consume everything in their horizon. Planets, moons, even stars. Don't worry," read the article, "no cause for concern. These events are rare and the universe vast." In After the Party, I Will Walk Alone into Snow-Covered Hills, Hornibrook writes that he will go become a hill and where easily the grass, in a gesture of Whitmanian expansiveness. Later we find out that the party isn't over, the guests just now knocking at the door, and that once again, imagination facilitates his escape from the social world. Hornibrook spent time working as a caregiver in suburban Detroit, and the person he shows us in these pages is deeply empathetic. The poem entitled Pony describes leaving a hospital after a shift through the subterranean passages where exposed pipes were veins connecting the walls to the workings of this beast whose hunger for the meat of people sounded like metal salt falling. I couldn't do it. Later in the poem, Hornibrook undergoes another transformation. I lost my body inside the shiny bones of a pony. During such moments of metamorphosis, we're reminded what the great Roman poet Ovid taught us centuries ago, that empathy and imagination are one.
That was John Freeman with his review of David Hornibrook's debut collection of poetry, Night Manual. After the break, end-of-life conversation with teens and young adults. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A diagnosis of a life-threatening illness is an enormous shockwave to any family. But when that diagnosis happens for a teen or a young adult, there are extra challenges. These kids know while their friends are getting ready for prom or for college, they're going through treatment or having tough conversations with family and doctors. Helping those conversations is the mission of Dr. Cynthia Bell, an assistant professor and a research scientist at the Wayne State University School of Nursing. Her special focus is on end-of-life conversations with teens and young adults. Cindy Bell, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
And it's a pleasure to welcome Caitlin Salch. As a high school student, she was part of Cindy's study called Ready or Not. That's because Caitlin was diagnosed at age 14 with cancer. Today, she is a nursing student at Boise State University in Idaho. So it's a pleasure to say, Caitlin, welcome all the way in Idaho.
Thank you so much.
Very good to have you here. Cindy, I know you were an oncology nurse for many years and then went back and got your PhD. What drew you to want to study and explore these end-of-life conversations with teens and young adults? I think we're probably, talking ages about 13 to 24?
Right. So I guess I was drawn to that through my clinical experience. So I worked for many years taking care of patients, and I found myself in this job in 1997 where I was actually helping people through the cancer experience. When they did not get cured of their cancer, then I was allowed to help them in their home to end of life. And so what I witnessed with adolescents and young adults was just a lot of turmoil and struggle as that time became closer, and just witnessing that, you know, the interactions with the family, both were trying to be so strong for each other, not wanting to harm the other one by talking about it. And it was just a very interesting dynamic, but it was also very sad because they were kind of going along this trajectory, socially isolated from each other, although in the same environment.
And not wanting to upset the other.
Right.
So then things don't get talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And then this study, this Ready or Not research you did, what were you exploring?
So I was exploring if the adolescents do want to talk about it and what they want to talk about with their parents or their clinicians, providers, healthcare professionals.
And I know one of the things you've learned is you've developed a tool that helps people kind of get a sense of when someone is ready to talk or not.
Right. So the tool that we developed is based on the construct of readiness. So it has three domains: awareness, acceptance, and willingness. And so we find out how aware they are of their condition, how emotionally accepting they are, and what they're willing to engage in as far as discussions go. And so it's fairly interesting. I mean, they've taught me a lot, but overwhelmingly, I have found that they are willing to talk and are thankful generally that someone is asking the questions.
So it's getting the questions started and just kind of getting down that path.
Right, right.
Well, I want to turn now to Caitlin. And just, Caitlin, fill us in on your life a little. When were you diagnosed? And tell us about that.
So, like you said, I was diagnosed when I was 14 years old. I actually went to the hospital the first day of my freshman year of high school.
So literally, it was like my entire high school experience. So I was originally diagnosed with synovial sarcoma. It's a soft tissue cancer, and I had a tumor on my diaphragm.
Wow. So then what happened? What kinds of experiences did you go through as you proceeded through high school? I mean, what a way to start your first day of high school.
Right? Yeah, it was great. Yes, I mean, in terms of treatment, I feel like I did everything. I did, like, chemotherapy. I've done radiation, surgery. After I got leukemia, I ended up doing a bone marrow transplant. I've gone down to Texas, and I've had referrals there. And so I feel like, in terms of that, I've kind of done everything.
And so tell us where you are today. Where do things stand in terms of the cancer experience that you've been having and also the fact that you're in college?
The first time that I was told that like my prognosis was really not that good, I was in high school. I couldn't even drive yet. And I honestly never thought that I would even graduate high school, let alone make it to college and have all these like goals and career options and stuff like that in my life. So in terms of like the cancer, last summer in July, I got another scan and the MRI showed 3 pretty sizely tumors. And that's when I first went to MD Anderson in Texas. And one of the oncologists there, she claims that she's seen the most synovial sarcoma patients in the world. She essentially told me that I had a couple of months to live and that was about it. My oncologist, though, wasn't going to like let that be an answer because she fought for me this entire time. And so I decided to do a chemotherapy. And so I moved home last fall and did a couple rounds of chemotherapy. And then we actually talked to a surgeon down at MD Anderson. He's amazing. And he felt that if we could get the tumors to shrink, that he would be comfortable to try to get them out and potentially make me cancer-free just by surgery and the chemo. And so far, I had a scan. I get them every 2 to 3 months now. And the first one has looked great. So this is amazing. Coming from, you have like 2, maybe 3 months to now I can start planning years in advance. It's awesome.
Well, and I'm just thinking, it goes without saying the kinds of insights you're going to bring to your patients as a nurse. So let's just put that on the table right now. Caitlin, what were conversations with your family like through the years? Have they kind of evolved? I mean, from that first wave of news on your first day of high school?
Yeah, they definitely have evolved. Obviously, it starts out with like, okay, you have this diagnosis. What do we need to do to get rid of it? You know, it's very like hands-on, very positive. Like you don't want to talk about bad things because it's extremely scary and you don't know anything. And so pretty much they just start out, we're going to fight this. We can do this. We're going to be here as a family. Especially my parents, they always try to be super positive before a scan just because they know that I have a lot of anxiety about it. But if I talk to them about a scan, like after a bad scan, they'll be like, oh, I kind of had a feeling. But they didn't tell me that until afterwards. It's just because I've had so many bad ones that it does kind of shift to, like, we've talked about, like, advanced directives and wills and, like, what do I want? And it kind of took a while for my parents to be okay with wanting to talk about that with me. And that was something that I've always kind of wanted to talk about just because it's real. It's right there.
Cindy Bell, what do you want to say about this amazing way that we're hearing Caitlin talk about this journey she's on?
I know. Caitlin is, she's so amazing. I mean, I am so inspired by your story, Caitlin. And I remember when I sat with you in the hospital. And I'm so glad, Caitlin, that you were able to have the advanced directives conversation because I remember talking to you before. Your parents were, you know, really resistant to anything that had to do with death and dying, and you had shared some stories about that. So I'm really glad that you have at least been able to have those open conversations, you know, to plan for the what if, but to not have to, you know, at the last minute try to figure out for your parents and you what is it that you want.
And I hear conversations. So, mm-hmm. you know, when we talk about it like an end-of-life conversation, it really is plural.
Exactly.
It should be.
It should be. And you know what we do, I think in pediatric oncology especially, I mean, we focus in a curative mindset. And so it becomes very difficult in oncology to have a conversation saying we can't do anything more because then, you know, you almost feel like you're failing, you know? And so when we do finally admit to that and say we can do nothing more, just having that one conversation, I always call it the conversation. I feel like it needs to be the beginning of many conversations. And what happens and what I witness, you know, many times is just with providers, difficulty, you know, we don't want to do harm. We don't want people to lose hope. Hope is very important. And we always want to hope for miracles and hope that, you know, cure can come. There are many good things happening. But in the same time, we have to also say, okay, where are you right now? What do you have going on in your head? What can we help you with so that you can continue to live well? So the conversations, when we get them out, it's all about helping you so you can live with what time you have, whatever time that is.
If you just joined us, we're talking about having difficult conversations with teens and young adults who are facing life-threatening illness. We're talking with Dr. Cynthia Bell, who's an assistant professor and a research scientist at Wayne State University's School of Nursing. And we're talking with Caitlin Saul, who is a nursing student at Boise State University in Idaho. And she has been on a cancer journey since she was diagnosed her first day of high school at age 14. Caitlin, you know, there are so many movies and TV shows and books that try to tell the stories of people who are on a cancer journey or are facing life-threatening illnesses. What do they get right and what do they get wrong in your view?
For the most part, if something has to do with like cancer or like a child or a teen getting cancer and like I know about it ahead of time, I honestly kind of avoid it. Just because I know that, like, I'm going to start crying or that something's going to come up. But obviously, like, it does show up. And, you know, a lot of things, I don't think they get right. But I do think some of the things that are, like, bigger deals, they do understand or they can portray in a certain way. I was just watching a TV show. This woman was doing chemo treatments and her hair was finally starting to fall out. And she just decided to shave it off. And while she was shaving it, she started like laughing and smiling type of thing as to feel like liberated. And I just got super like, nope, that's not right. That is not how that goes. Like, it's the worst thing of your life. Like, that is the most traumatic thing I've had to go through, which sounds kind of superficial. But, you know, when you're 14 years old and you just started high school, that's kind of a big deal.
You bet. Caitlin, what about new people in your life? Here you are, you're off to college now, Boise State University. So when you meet new people, do you choose to tell them? And if so, when and how? I'm wondering if you've got a certain approach or phrase that maybe is your go-to approach. How do you do this?
So when I first meet somebody, I don't want them just to automatically think of me as the person with cancer or who's had cancer or something like that, just because I don't know if they change their opinion on you, but how they react with you and interact with you changes. And I don't think they mean to, but it just does. It's kind of like they feel sorry for you that you had to go through that. And so I think it's kind of like they almost distance themselves right away. But yeah, I think I might be different than a lot of people as I'm very open about it. Like, honestly, I don't think there's a question anyone could ask that I'm going to be offended by and not want to answer. And so, however it kind of naturally comes up in a conversation is usually just how I go about, like, talking to them about it.
Cindy, when you think of what you've learned, what are the best pieces of advice that you could offer families who have a teenager, a young adult who's on that journey? What are the do's and don'ts, if we could make it that? Is it that simplistic?
I think the do's are to be present, to trust yourself, to not be afraid to ask, and to ask a very open question, like, what is it like right now in your life today? What's it like for you? And let them tell you the story. And so I think just asking the questions, that's the biggest thing. I mean, you have to ask, and then you have to be willing to hear. And then also be sensitive enough to know that you don't always want to live in that place. You know, so there are these stages of awareness, you know, that you can go through. And Glaser and Strauss wrote about this in a study they did, a classic study in 1968. And they found that, You know, you can be in closed awareness where you don't know, like if you have a terminal illness, you don't know if you're going to die from it, right? But the doctor does. And then you can go into this suspected awareness where you're kind of like, maybe I do have this, and you're looking for cues. Then you move into this stage called mutual pretense, where you know and the doctor knows what's happening, but you both decide not to talk about it. So you mutually kind of agree not to talk about it. And then you have open awareness, where both know, and then you openly communicate. Well, what I found with adolescents is that, you know, when they move into that open awareness with, oh my goodness, I could die from this, like they don't want to stay there. They might want to be there for a moment or for a time to process things, but they need to go out of that, and you need to let them go out of that, and you need to let them be in those places where they have hopes and dreams and want to accomplish goals. And like Caitlin, actually, she's assisted with cancer research in her university. She's a brilliant, you know, scholar, and so she could do anything she wanted to do, but like allowing her to continue to have those dreams and those hopes and those goals. Very, very important developmentally for a young person. Their life doesn't stop just because they have a life-threatening diagnosis. And so just being open to talk about that in the same way that we're encouraging these other very difficult conversations that no one wants to have with them.
And it goes back and forth.
Back
I'm sure,
and forth. Back and forth. Yes.
Caitlin, anything you want to add to that? What are some do's and don'ts based on what you've experienced?
You know, I think Cindy was completely right when she said that, you know, we go into these like little moments where we do kind of panic and we're thinking about it a lot. And we're like, okay, you know, this is real. What if I do die? I kind of want to have a plan. I want my parents to know, you know. And I definitely had those moments, and they weren't very often, but they did happen. And I think it is really important to be there. And I didn't necessarily need somebody to start the conversation, for me at least. I just needed somebody to listen. It wasn't necessarily that I wanted them to reply or try to change my mind or anything of the sorts. I just kind of wanted them to listen to my fears and hear me out at where I was in that moment. And just being able to say it out loud kind of was enough for me to get through it. My dad was that person for me when I would have those moments of like, oh my gosh, I'm really scared. I don't want to go to treatment tomorrow, or I can't go on anymore. When you have those feelings, like when I would talk to my dad and he would just listen to me. He would never try to say like, oh, are you just trying to like give up, or okay, fine, we won't go tomorrow or anything like that. He was just there to listen to me. And when I was done, I would be crying, but he would be there and he would just give me a massive hug until I was ready to let go. And he would just be there to support me. And I definitely had those different stages of awareness. And I've had a couple real questions for them. Like this last time, it was really, really bad. And I had to decide if I wanted to do chemo or just, you know, live my life here until it was the end, you know, because there was a chance that it wasn't going to work and then I'd be bald and miserable before I died. And I didn't want that either. And so one day, just when I was thinking about it so much, I called her and I was like, hey, am I going to die, or when, how? Because these were real questions that I had when I was contemplating doing chemo. And she was honest with me. She told me how I would most likely die from this and potentially like a timeline of when. And it was the honesty that I was ready for and that I needed.
Well, I'm just saying, your patients are going to be very blessed when you bring your insights and your caring. Mm-hmm. Cindy, you've got this tool with these questions and cards. Is that something that people can access? Is that, or is it for other professionals?
Oh, yeah. So it's in the very early stages of development. So we've developed the tool, and we've validated it with content experts, and then we've tested them in people like Caitlin. So we've gone through and said, talking to my doctors or nurses about my illness makes them sad. And Caitlin would say, not at all true, somewhat true, generally true, almost always true. And so if we know, like, if they understand it or if it's clear enough, if they don't even think it's important, like, we had some ones that were really sensitive. And so that's what I think I appreciated most about, you know, going through that validity testing with the adolescents and young adults themselves. And so if it was a little too sensitive, I mean, they weren't afraid to say, you know, hey, that's a tough one. And I think it's an important question, but I wouldn't want to talk about that all the time. So maybe just picking the right time to say, do you want to have your, you know, if my disease would continue to progress, do I want to have conversations with my parents about end-of-life discussions? And so I think we're learning a lot from it. So what we need to do at this stage is another study. We're going to involve parents and healthcare professionals and the patient and kind of test some of these items out. But hopefully, science takes forever, but hopefully it will get into the hands of the right people with all these awesome adolescents and young adults like Caitlin that are helping us to figure out how we can make the best tool or instrument for them.
Well, it's been just a pleasure to talk with both of you. Caitlin Saul, thank you for sharing your story and best of luck with your nursing studies.
Yes, Caitlin.
Thank you so much.
And Cindy Bell, assistant professor and research scientist at Wayne State University School of Nursing. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.